Welcome to Legacy of Distress, Medical Apartheid in Relation to COVID-19 Vaccine Development and Distribution, where we'll be discussing medical racism in relation to the COVID-19 vaccine development, distribution, and public perception. We will be speaking with Dr. Amara Siva to provide perspectives on not only how this vaccine is planned to be distributed among the most vulnerable communities, such as indigenous population, but also how the vaccine is perceived within these marginalized communities that have had such a complicated and damaged history with healthcare professionals. Our hope is that listeners will finish this podcast with a better understanding of how COVID-19 has impacted various marginalized communities, how this knowledge is being incorporated into vaccine distribution policies, and the unique factors that contribute to vaccine distrust and disinterest in many communities. Hi, I'm your host, Hamza, and to kick off this podcast, I'm calling in with Ruby and Luis to get a brief history and explanation of medical racism and how it impacts vaccination programs. To start, can you define medical racism for me? Where does it show up and how does it impact people?
Of course, medical racism is defined as the systematic and widespread racism against people of color within the medical system. This involves racism which infiltrates into all phases of healthcare, including the structural inequalities that influence rates of sickness, access to care, and health outcomes. As a result of medical racism, marginalized communities often have higher rates of illness and worsened health outcomes when it comes to many specific conditions such as heart disease, HIV and AIDS, cancer, maternal health complications, and more.
When you say systemic and systematic racism in healthcare, what does that mean?
Institutional racism, also known as systemic racism, is a form of racism that is embedded as normal practice within society or an organization. What this means for medical racism is that racism is not just found in direct and obvious acts of discrimination, but also embedded within health policies, insurance policies, medical devices, treatment, and research practices, and more.
I'm not sure if I fully understand how this shows up in real life. Can you give me some examples throughout history that exemplify different types of medical racism?
Yes, one widely known example of medical racism was the Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis, which is often cited as the largest contributor to the toxic relationship between Black Americans and healthcare systems. This atrocious study began in 1932, when the United States Public Health Service recruited Black men to Alabama, claiming they would receive free medical care for bad blood, a term historically referring to syphilis and other similar diseases. It turned out, however, that this promise of free care was merely a ruse to exploit Black Americans for research on the effects of syphilis when left entirely unchecked in the body. These men were coerced to have faith in a false treatment and denied proper care by a government research program. Even when penicillin became available as a treatment for syphilis in 1947, the Black men in the study were prevented from receiving the life-saving drug. The truth was only uncovered after 40 years in 1972, but by then 128 patients had died and several family members were infected by the disease.
This Tuskegee study is only one case in a long history of medical racism in America. Many more examples of systemic discrimination can be found in the Mississippi appendectomies, eugenic sterilization, the practice of phrenology, racist medical devices such as the spirometer, and more. Black, Indigenous, and people of color in the U.S. have been exploited throughout history for medical trials, and then, often through direct discrimination or structural barriers, they're denied access to the medical technology these trials help produce. For example, the famous HeLa cells, which have been used in research studies for many years, were taken from a Black woman, Henrietta Lacks, without knowledge, consent, or compensation for her or her family members. Despite this reality, the scientific knowledge produced using these HeLa cells has disproportionately been used in ways that benefit white Americans, not people of color. Scientific abuses, exploitations, and examples of medical neglect like these can be found throughout the history of the U.S.
This long and deeply entrenched history of medical racism has also come to be known as a medical apartheid within the U.S. In her book on medical apartheid, Harriet Washington argues that diverse forms of racial discrimination have shaped both the relationship between white physicians and Black patients, and the attitude of the latter towards modern medicine in general. She also demonstrates the many ways in which medical racism is tied in with colonialism and imperialism outside of the US, with white Americans co-opting and stealing traditional medical practices, erasing and suppressing non-Western forms of knowledge production, and forcing medical trials and experimentation onto vulnerable communities. This history has created an incredibly deeply entrenched pattern of distrust between people of color within and outside of the US, and the American politicians, public health officials, and medical professionals.
So how does medical racism relate to the COVID-19 vaccine specifically?
What we've seen with COVID-19 research is that there's clearly a racialized pattern in how COVID-19 impacts health, as well as Americans' interest in receiving the vaccine once it's available to them. Multiple analyses of available federal, state, and local data show that people of color are experiencing a disproportionate burden of COVID-19 cases and deaths. Black Americans die from COVID-19 at nearly triple the rate of white Americans and account for 15% of COVID-19 deaths. The Hispanic and Latino American death rate is 2.8 times the rate of whites, and Indigenous people die at about 2.5 times the rate of whites. These disparities occur for many reasons, including the fact that Black and Latinx Americans are more likely to be employed in essential roles and exposed to the virus. Black, Native, and Latinx Americans are also more likely to be uninsured and are more likely to have pre-existing conditions that increase risk of virus complications. Black, Native, and Latinx Americans also have less access to medical facilities and medical supplies, and they're more likely to live in dense, multi-generational housing, which increases COVID-19 exposure for vulnerable individuals. Language barriers could even delay information about exposure to COVID-19 or ways to get treatment. Despite this reality, the Pew Research Center reports only 43% of African Americans would get a COVID-19 vaccine if it were available to them, which is the lowest of any racial group they surveyed. According to the Kaiser Foundation's COVID-19 vaccine monitor, 35% of Black adults say they would probably or definitely not take the vaccine.
We have to remember that the COVID-19 vaccine is not only novel in the pace that it's been developed and tested, but also embedded within this long historical context of medical racism and apartheid. The Pfizer clinical trial contained 83% white participants, while only 9% were Black or African American, and 28% were Hispanic or Latinx. The racial demographics of the vaccine research and early distribution efforts are nowhere near representative of the disproportionate COVID-19 burden that minorities have faced. And widespread reports show that wealthy white Americans have often been driving to vaccine sites and wrongfully monopolizing appointments. Minority communities have clearly experienced a disproportionate burden of COVID-19, and overcoming this legacy of distrust will be essential in order to end the pandemic in an effective and equitable manner.
So far, we've talked a lot about the history of medical racism at large and the sheer impact we've seen of the COVID-19 virus on Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities. But one might wonder what medical racism looks like in more recent times. Terrence Keel, professor at UCLA's Institute for Society and Genetics and Department of African American Studies, states that if Black people were suspicious of the polio vaccine, it's because eugenics was still happening in this country at the time. And in fact, one could say that they are. Today, there are several obstacles preventing American minorities from receiving the same level of healthcare treatment as white Americans. Many health insurance companies often impose discriminatory pricing, longer waiting periods, and even additional charges on conditions more prevalent in certain minority groups. Some cases of racism in public healthcare are more overt. Implicit bias can often affect how minorities are treated in medical settings. One public health study found that approximately 8% of patients felt that a doctor or medical staff member judged them unfairly because of their race. And many others report blatant bigotry expressed towards people of Black, Indian, and Jewish heritage in medical settings. So clearly, the problem isn't an isolated case, but a much more systemic one. Today, people of color are disproportionately underrepresented in clinical trials due to the public distrust and lack of information in under-resourced hospital systems. And yet, Black men are hugely overrepresented in what many consider the most dangerous phases of inhuman vaccination research, called Phase 1 studies. You see, the sole purpose of Phase 1 studies is not to determine whether the vaccine works or not, it's to simply show whether or not a vaccine can actually hurt someone. By asking questions like, does it make you vomit, make it hard to breathe, or cause a migraine, these tests put people of color in precarious situations of uncertainty with no possibility of medical benefit. According to sociologist Jill A. Fisher, who traveled across different Phase 1 testing sites, patients are placed in subpar facilities in which they are made to feel as though they were in jail or less than human. Staff confiscate anything with a camera, and patients are placed in windowless residential clinics for days or even weeks at a time. When Fisher interviewed patients, almost nobody expressed interest in being part of another Phase 1 trial. Yet black men are constantly coerced under the pretense of minor compensation when they are exposed to adverse healthcare and a severe lack of human treatment. Christy Lipford, Assistant Professor of Health Equity and Urban Studies at Rhodes College, summarizes the experience well, saying, "People's mistrust comes from direct experience. We know that African Americans report very low level of satisfaction with doctors and hospital visits, and they also report very high levels of discrimination in the same settings." Clearly, there are many ways that medical racism can take form, and it's not just through the phase 1 trials. Until today, medicine treats black bodies as fundamentally different from any other race. Despite the continued lack of scientific evidence, many fields, such as cardiology, pulmonology, and several others, employ algorithms that exclude many minorities from receiving treatment. Medical discrimination still exists today, and much more needs to be done to address the deeply rooted skepticism of public healthcare. But can these problems be overcome with current plans to address COVID-19? In the next section, we tackle vaccine distribution in Indigenous populations.
When we talk about which demographics are the most vulnerable to COVID-19, we've already established that Indigenous folks have been among the most affected. Will you expand a little more on why COVID-19 has been so bad in these communities?
So to start out, Indigenous people are 4 times as likely to be hospitalized with COVID-19 in America. When it comes to access to healthcare resources on reservations for mitigating this rate of infection, there's often limitations that affect implementation for the best preventative measures. Native Americans receive lower funding for infrastructure and medical care, and reservations are often severely isolated from the nearest hospitals or clinics, which really impacts the quality of the care that these patients are able to receive. This distance also means that the temperature sensitivity of the vaccines for COVID-19 is affected, which limits the tribe's ability to receive and store the vaccines. As a result, tribes have been limited to the Moderna vaccine since they don't really have the capabilities to reliably store the Pfizer vaccine, which requires these extreme temperature freezers. Native populations largely live in multi-generational households in some of the poorest areas in America, and the social and economic conditions of these reservations are a clear result of settler colonialism, marginalization, and oppression throughout U.S. history. Abigail Echo Hawk, director of the Seattle-based Urban Indian Health Institute, has spoken for the Seattle Native community, saying, "We're more at risk because we are Native people living in the United States, where we've been experiencing this kind of oppression for the past 500 years. Because reservations are often in food deserts, most tribes have a strong unit and have set stores to buy from, like the Navajo Nation. With only 13 grocery stores, it makes it much more likely for crowds to form, where COVID-19 is able to really spread throughout this population, right? And 40% of the Navajo Nation's households don't even have access to running water, which makes sanitation an even greater problem. In environments where it's exceptionally difficult to socially distance and prioritize sanitation for preventative measures, we can see how this creates a hotbed for COVID-19 to manifest in this population. In combination with these barriers to care, Indigenous people are at a greater risk for COVID-19 because of disproportionate burdens of pre-existing conditions such as asthma and diabetes."
What does the actual distribution of vaccines look like in these Native communities? How receptive are Natives to the vaccine, with a deep-rooted history of medical racism and exploitation directed at them?
The federal government determines the amount of vaccines that get designated to each jurisdiction, and so that's states, local governments, and tribal governments. These allocations are determined by expert advisory panels, which include tribal leaders and Native advocates, and are based on an area's need and capability for storing and administering the vaccine. Each jurisdiction is then responsible for receiving and approving orders from local distributors, and so that's pharmacies, clinics, etc., and over 300 tribal health programs and organizations have registered with the Indian Health Service, which is a department of the U.S. Health and Human Services, to receive vaccine shipments, with most distributions going to larger tribal health centers, which are then divided and distributed to the other local tribes that might not have the same storage capabilities. Many healthcare workers were eager to receive the vaccine out of fear of contracting the virus, but they were also hesitant because of the damaged history between the Indigenous and U.S. healthcare system. We'll hear more on this from Dr. Siva in just a bit.
What unique plans does the U.S. government have in place for regaining trust with these communities?
The The CDC and other U.S. agencies are working closely with Indigenous leaders to ensure that their voices are heard throughout the process and adopt practices that will be most equitable to all populations. They're also working with Indigenous leaders to boost vaccine trust and acceptance on reservations, but much more work is still needed to be done. Now to hear a little bit more on this topic from Dr. Amara Siva, Chief of Operations for Discovery Genomics, a genomics lab that's based in Newport Beach, California, that pivoted at the start of the pandemic to provide the gold standard of COVID-19 testing. As of recently, the lab has also been accepted as a COVID-19 vaccine distributor to the American public. Dr. Siva has over 20 years of experience in molecular diagnostics and therapeutic drug discovery. Dr. Siva, could you tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. So I'm a native Californian. I did my bachelor's at UC San Diego and my PhD at UCLA, and both in biochemistry. And I then went into, did a postdoc at the Salk Institute in virology, studying particularly HIV back then. And I've done a lot of clinical lab work since then. So in urine drug testing at Millennium Health, pharmacogenetics, and then moved into COVID testing last year when the pandemic started. And, you know, that's where we are. And one day we'll get back to doing cancer research and whole genome sequencing. But for now, it's COVID testing. And I'm also a member of the Los Coyotes Band of Cahuilla and Campeño Indians, Cahuilla on my mother's side. That reservation is at Warner Springs, California. But I have family members across all of basically Southern California on Morongo Reservation, Torres Martinez, Cahuilla, all over Southern California.
Thank you so much. So we're really looking to get your perspective on how the relationship between public health officials, medical professionals, and racial minorities can begin to be repaired.
So that's a pretty, that's a hard question. I would say that it's not enough for doctors or nurses or anybody at, the clinics, the community clinics to say, well, you need to be vaccinated, you need to take this medication. It's really going to have to be somebody who's adopting that from inside that community and really, you know, working to spread that knowledge and that perspective to, you know, the elders or to, you know, the young people, and really kind of drive that adoption, because it's just, there's just so much mistrust. I mean, even from my own experience, for me, and it's kind of humbling, because I have been contacted so many times within the last year from family members. So my aunt saying that there is a question for my other aunt who lives in Oklahoma, my uncle who lives in Florida, and they all want to know what I think about the vaccine or masks or whatever. But it's because they're looking to me as like sort of an insider person that's trustworthy and will give them real information, you know, from also the healthcare professional side. So I think it's really going to take adoption of that by community members, and those community members having to work to spread the word within their communities to get them to adopt it.
Thank you so much for that insight, Dr. Siva. It really sounds like the system won't be able to begin repairing itself until there's representation from within the community, from Native leaders who can speak in a larger capacity on these issues to this audience, just because there's so much distrust within this community, right? Now, on a similar note, we're going to hear from Osvaldo on vaccine distribution and the incarceration system, one that's notorious for targeting people of color, especially Black, Latinx, and Native communities.
Hello, my name is Osvaldo Sanchez Fernandez, and I'm going to dive into the details on vaccine distribution and the distrust in another historically marginalized community, that is, incarcerated populations. Due to systematic racism, people of color are incarcerated at a much higher rate, and incarcerated populations tend to be isolated from proper healthcare, dismissed by federal support programs, and abandoned during the COVID-19 pandemic, a time when we should all be standing together to help combat it. If we look at the history behind healthcare for prisoners, We can see that there is some rooted prejudice. This rooted prejudice takes many shapes and forms, which leads to many negative consequences that might not be apparent at first. Let's discuss the social prejudice against immigrants and how it relates to a contemporary issue involving the distribution of vaccines. So you might ask yourself, to get the whole picture, don't we need to first discuss the problem that surrounds the prison system? Well, yes, you are totally right. Many prisoners across America are vulnerable targets for COVID-19 and lack the proper management for the vaccines on the incarcerated, which can have both immediate and long-term effects. It was estimated that prisoners are four times as likely to contract COVID-19 and twice as likely to die from COVID-19 than the general public. To figure out the cause for this great statistic, we have to explore the economics and social problems that many face. Many prisons are not properly funded and thus lack proper management to handle the necessary steps to keep the prisoners safe from the disease. Most prisoners across America are overcrowded and allow for personal contact amongst prisoners and officials to be common, which can easily lead to the spread of the disease. What makes things worse is that many prisoners are denied soap, masks, and cleaning supplies, which are essential for keeping the disease from spreading. As we see, there are many things wrong with the prison system itself that makes it easier for the COVID-19 to spread. What about the social stigma that surrounds prisoners, you may ask? Well, we encounter this stigma around people in prison. The public often accuses all prisoners of being bad people and holds some sort of prejudice against them. Even the governor of Colorado highlights this prejudice in a recent statement. There's no way it's going to prisoners before it goes to the people who haven't committed any crime, even though prisoners themselves are amongst the most vulnerable to contract COVID-19. Many people fail to realize the lasting impact from not wanting to vaccinate prisoners. This only contributes to the rapid spread of the disease because it can pass it off to guards, other prisoners, and even the visiting family and friends, who can then spread it to the public and increase even more the virality of the disease. So now we will be concluding our podcast. What is essential to take away from this podcast is that cultural competency and considerations of historical and social influences on healthcare are necessary in order to practice the type of medicine that promotes equity and justice. The misconception that all those who refuse or hold reservations about the COVID-19 vaccine are simply uneducated, misinformed, or anti-scientific is a dangerous one, as it completely erases the reality of so many Americans that do not have the privilege of living with the assumption that medical professionals are always on their side. Further research must be done to understand how COVID-19 vaccines can be provided to communities in a way that is sensitive to their history, cultural values, and previous experiences with the medical community. So this concludes our podcast, and thank you everyone else for hearing us out, and I hope you enjoyed it.